Okay, David, so you're here on the island. Tell me what you've been doing.
I've been, for the most part, just trying to enjoy the land. I've spent a lot of time on varying beaches, driving my motorcycle through the mountains, reading. Most of all, though, just trying to focus on the practice of listening to my deepest intuition and gladdening the mind and contemplating.
All right. What do you want to talk about today?
What comes to mind immediately is I can absolutely see the truth in what we last we spoke in gladdening the mind and in realizing. Trying to get over the idea of being recorded. I'm fine with being recorded. The last time we spoke, you told me to work on just simply bringing joy and gratitude into the moment of being alive. And I can absolutely see that my tone of mind often is negative and pessimistic or unwholesome. But
kind of want to fix the world.
Yeah, maybe to a degree. But I also can see that some of my suffering, at least in my understanding and in what I've seen through my practice, is life trying to reorient me towards the correct path. And so my suffering isn't just random and nonsensical. It's actually there to guide me to the lack of suffering, to touching the proverbial stove, taking the hand off, acting incorrectly. How do you act correctly? And when I listen to my suffering most deeply, it points me to reassessing my own choices in life, my own relationships to myself, to other people, to the people I love, and the way that I carry myself through this time on the earth. And so I see, when I practice, a differentiation between suffering, which is taking the pain that is there to instruct me and whirlpooling it into something greater. But I can't see that pain is not there as a guide as well, as a teacher.
Actually, quite a lot can be said about that idea that pain and suffering is a teacher. If it were, you would have been a miracle Dhamma dude when you were in diapers. The fact is that dukkha is ignorant.
Yes.
It is not a teacher. The teacher would be that you don't have to suffer.
Yes.
That's the whole point, is to being able to see it so that you don't step in it.
Yes. So I agree. I can absolutely see that my ignorance is it is not wise ignorance, or my suffering is not wise suffering. But if I listen to it, it's not there to just make me feel bad. It's there, like you said, to not step in it. And for whatever reason, I'm a very poor practitioner, a very, dumb man, because I've repeatedly made the same mistakes over and over and over, almost for a lifetime.
Long time.
A long time. Yes. A long time.
Over and over and over again. And that right there kind of proves that it wasn't a teacher at all. Now, it might have wanted to be a teacher, but without a student, what's a teacher?
Exactly. And I feel like, what is it, Gautama Buddha said, that the root of evil is ignorance. It's the ignorance of it. And so it's not that the stimulus of pain is the problem. It's my own ignorance to the pain and my lack of conception and my lack of awareness.
Not ignorance to the pain, but ignorance that this is dukkha, this is pain.
Yes, yes, yes. I can absolutely see that, because many things that I have repeatedly done are things that at the moment feel good, seem good, entertainment, escapism, all of this stuff that feels nice. But then that deeper suffering, that deeper wisdom says, this is not the way to live a life. This is not the way to relate to being, to totality. And then that kind of wise pain creeps back.
You can, in fact, go back earlier than that. What do I mean is that when you're out looking for something, while you're looking, you're the dukkha that's in the moment was caused by dukkha that you had missed, and now you're out looking for something. All right. And so what we actually have to do is to back up, and that takes a bit of practice, is to back up and say, oh, I'm here. I got here because of this, because I wasn't watching what was going on then. Okay. An example of that, and this, a lot of students just had trouble with this. They say they sit down and are practicing Anapanasati, and then they experience agitation, anxiety. And the question then would be, in the beginning question, would be, is this brand new anxiety, or is it old stuff? And upon reflection, they recognize that it's old, okay, that it's a habit that we've gotten into. And often when we're out busy in life, we're not recognizing that we were busy because we were driven, and we were driven by the anxiety that we were trying to get rid of. And now the student is sitting in meditation and they're experiencing anxiety, and they don't recognize that this particular anxiety in this particular moment, 2 seconds before that, was an unwholesome thought that gave rise to this anxiety that's happening now.
So I absolutely can see that in my own experience, in my own practice. And I have spent the last 7 years, actually, most of my life has been focused on practicing. That's why I've been traveling. That's why I've studied in all of these traditions. So what you just said, I've gotten to that point where I have been able to follow the chain of thoughts to the unwholesome feeling. And I can go back and see the karma of mind. And I can also see in my historical record, where I have diverged from the way. What I have struggled with since then has, despite knowing, still going through habitual patterns, still going through these kleshas over and over and over. And it's like I've had the moment of insight and wisdom, yet still there's this dullness and stupidness to my mind or my soul that just doesn't get it.
All right. So, you used just now the word struggle, and you used that you're going, now that you can see things, you can see that you're going through that cycle over and over again, and you're struggling. And the point is that you don't like it. All right.
Don't like
that you can change. Instead of seeing the cycle happening over and over again and struggling with it because you don't like it, how about changing that to you're going through this over and over again? Why can't you enjoy it since you're going to be doing it anyway?
Well, in my experience, and again, I'm speaking from somebody who, just in my direct experience, what I've looked for and understood, these things that I don't enjoy are things that are detrimental to me. So be it... A very low resolution example would be like watching YouTube to escape the moment. Entertainment as a new form of drug, as a way of kind of, as escaping life. And I can see my mind going into these dull spirals. And rather than, I don't want to like touching the stove. I want to learn to stop burning my hand. I want to learn to stop doing things that are burning me. And I mean, in my life, I've had issues, whether it's with entertainment, with fast food, you know, eating foods that are detrimental to my body, relating to women in ways that is not leading to love and connection. And I don't want to like or to gladden my mind to actions that are not beneficial. I want to learn how to instead change my mind or my action, right?
Okay. Well, again, you missed the point. So let's go back over it one more time. And that is that your bad behavior is not a habit that is there that you can deal with by not liking it. That's just being more critical of yourself. And while you're more critical with yourself, you will continue then to escape that criticism by going off and doing it again. Someplace in here, we have to break the cycle. Okay.
So,
and the cycle breaking point then is to begin to see what it is and enjoy seeing what it is. But here you're caught in the cycle of seeing what it is, and then you don't like it. So you go from one wholesome unwholesome state to yet another unwholesome state right then. And the Buddha has that statement, aha, I see you, Myra, which is gladdening the mind right then and there. I see you.
So what we're saying is it's not then enjoying binging on McDonald's. It's enjoying, I see what you're doing here. I catch you. And so it does lead out of that cycle, but it's not through hatred, self-hatred, self-condemnation. It's through awareness and through the gratitude of awareness, the gladdening of awareness.
Mm-hmm. You begin to gladden the mind because you now can see that you can gladden your mind even when you see the wrongdoing or what you're considering unwholesome behavior.
So there's the gladness that you see, oh, there is a way to change. There's a way.
That is the change.
That is the change itself through the awareness.
Changing it right then and there. That as you are seeing that you're caught in that cycle, instead of seeing you caught in the cycle and hating the cycle, that's just going to continue to perpetuate the cycle. But once you can see that you're caught in the cycle, you say, aha, I see that cycle. That interrupts the cycle.
And like you say, that alone does change the construct. It is no longer A, B, C, D. It's now A, B, C, D, E. So there is a new stimulus, a new piece that changes the whole.
Well, if you look at it like that, A, B, C, D, A, B, C, D, and D leads back to A, but yeah. If you can go for an A, B, C, E, D, 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 then you don't go to the D, yeah. All right? That you're breaking that cycle through gladdening the mind.
I love that. And it's. I think we were speaking last time of not being in the victim stance that many people in the West have. Life is happening to me. I am suffering. This is this. Mm-hmm. This is
I'm
this.
Caught in the cycle.
I'm caught in the cycle. Not just
it's a vicious cycle, and I'm the one that's being eaten.
And all of life is that vicious cycle, right? And it until people feel as though life is against them, and mm-hmm. that is the exact wrong frame. The exact wrong frame. Rather than realizing the beauty of life, the transcendence of life, literal transcendence. And in seeing that, it's breaking that cycle of A, B, C, D that leads to suffering, and instead A, B, C, E, you see a new way to react and respond and live amidst totality, Dhamma, God, everything, and you can change that relation.
Right. And you can also see that the cycle that has been perpetuating all this time is not necessarily such a bad cycle. I mean, you're still alive. It didn't kill you yet. It hasn't strangled you or put you to the ground. But, and so your criticism of yourself is kind of overdoing it.
So to be very honest, I'm not a drug addict or an alcoholic or anything, but I have family members who were. And now if I'm thinking of their situation, they are destroying their lives. And so... So shouldn't there be a condemnation?
That's your judgment that they're destroying their lives.
I mean,
they may disagree with you.
Well, some of them have passed away, but I think they would agree that they've really hurt themselves, right? I've had friends who've been addicted to drugs, family members who have alcohol.
If they do the drugs and then criticize themselves and hate themselves and see the only option back out of hate, self-hatred, is to go back into the drugs... then it's their, it's not the drugs that are killing them, it's their self-criticism that's killing them. Thou shalt not.
Because their self-criticism leads them into drug use, or because
their self-criticism leads them into misery and suffering that they want to escape. And then they go do drugs to self to escape from the self. And then after they've taken the drugs, they've harmed themselves again. And so now they become critical of themselves again. They become a victim of their life. So the place to break this cycle is when we see that we've done wrong, is to congratulate ourselves for seeing it. Okay? If the drug addict will, in fact, stop criticizing himself for doing drugs, but start telling him he's okay already, then maybe in a minute or two he can say he's okay already without the drugs.
So what you're pointing to is that it's not the drugs themselves that are the preceding moment. It's the tone of mind that is condemnation, self-hatred, victim stance, the attitude. And from that attitude, then one does escape through drugs or behavior or whatever it is. And by breaking that attitude, you break the preceding event that leads to the drugs or whatever it is, right? And so it's the fix is not to not use drugs. The fix is to fix the mind that wants to use drugs via self-condemnation.
Right, the self-criticism, the self-condemnation, which is exactly what you were talking about that you're doing. Yeah. You just decided to travel as a drug rather than...
I haven't been traveling as a drug. It's been trying to explore varying cultures' ways of relating to reality. I think in the West, we have a very dead-end philosophy of what is...
You're looking for something.
Looking for understanding of what life and how other cultures have related to meaning.
Okay.
Via whether it is
understanding.
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
All right. So that's the drug then, looking for understanding.
I feel like in the West we kind of live in the aftermath of the death of God, as Nietzsche said. And right now there's a void in terms of how we perceive reality. Most people simply live in pure materialism where there is nothing. And so my traveling has not been escaped as much as how can I comprehend higher perceptions of being and what have others in other cultures and other times seen and understood. And also there's something when you stand in the middle of the Himalaya and, you know, snow leopards pass in front of you. And when you're in the middle of the deserts, the great deserts of the world, your mind and life changes orientation to nature. You see that this world is vast and significant in a way that in New York
so that Nietzsche in fact was wrong, that in fact the real issue is then that Nietzsche, with a whole lot of help both before and after, tried to bury God because they thought it was dead. And that's probably the right pronoun to use, is it. Because God is neither masculine nor feminine, just like the Garden of Eden, or perhaps paradise. Is paradise a him or a her or an it? It's an it, basically.
I think that I'm not a Nietzschean, I'm not a big Nietzschean philosopher, but I think what he was pointing to was that in our increasing intelligence, we've lost a belief or a view that the world had a transcendent domain. And that was what we used to historically call God, not that that was the literal machination of it.
That was the mistake, though, that God is not transcendent. Man is looking for the transcendent, while God is sitting in your lap.
Yes. Yeah, well, I don't think he'd actually disagree with that, that the transcendent is actually here, present, and now. But the issue is that man...
Well, the reason that man was looking for the transcendent was because he wasn't satisfied with the way things are.
But isn't there, last night I sat out at Tom Sadat, I think that's the name, Tom Sadat, the beach up in the far northwest, beautiful, beautiful beach. And I watched the full moon rise and I sat there. And I think that our attempt to understand transcendence, which transcendence is just a word, you know, it's just a sound. I'm making it. There is no inherent meaning behind that sound. But what is being pointed to, you know, the Buddha's finger to the moon, is us comprehending the scale of what it means to be human, to be alive amidst, to be made of burnt, you know, embers of stars, and to be moving through infinite space and time, and to comprehend that in the palm of our hand and in our lap and here and now, and then to love our neighbor, to love our lover, to love our child from that vantage point, where if we don't have that view, we can live in a very destructive, blind way. And it's, history is filled with that. So I feel like that's what people are seeking in the transcendent. It's not to join a religion or to know, it's to fully, as much as possible, comprehend a scale of meaning beyond himself, which he is also equally a part of.
Okay. Well, the drug addict family that you were talking about, and your search for understanding, and other people's search for the transcendent, is all the same thing, in the sense that they're in a state of dissatisfaction and they're looking for a cure to that outside of themselves. Okay, the drug addict is looking for a cure to his misery in the drug. Nietzsche is, in a way, or a whole lot of people and a whole lot of religions are looking for the way out of their moment-by-moment dissatisfactions in the transcendent. And you were looking for it in understanding.
Yeah, and just to be very clear, though, I'm not saying that the transcendent is some external thing. It's more so to awaken my own sleeping self to what is in front of me, and what is in within you, what is within the dog.
That's kind of a wisdom, though, that most of them don't have. They're still looking for God on the outside.
Sure. But even if you go into those conversations.
In fact, they even talk about it as a relationship with God, a relationship with God.
But I think what's being, my understanding,
which is missing the point.
And I think it's also, though, in the Western tradition, they've anthropomorphized the Dhamma. They've anthropomorphized that ideal path. Or in the West, or rather the East, we've made it into.
Well, they're experts at doing that because they've anthropomorphized themselves in
sure.
the first place.
Sure. And so, but so when they say a relationship with my, when I listen to people from different cultures or languages, you know, I translate a little bit. And I think that that's similar to somebody enacting the Dhamma, living the Dhamma. So it's a relationship to a way. And that's what people are trying to understand. They might still have a idea of a guy with a beard in the sky. And that's unwholesome, or maybe that's like, but in Vajrayana you have the deities and it's still tools.
God, so I, is
to some people, but at the same time, I mean, I've studied with Trappist monastics, and for them God is that cloud of unknowing, that full immersion into being itself, and there is no external God. It is just simply all of being. And
okay, well, now you've thrown back a point about the cloud of unknowing. And that what you've already said was that you were searching for understanding, okay? Within the teaching of the Buddha, there is the 10 fetters. Have you ever heard of them? Okay, do you know what the last and top fetter is? It's ignorance. We start with ignorance, and then we end up with ignorance. What changes in the between is not ignorance. What changes is our relationship to ignorance. That in fact you have heard that wise men recognize, part of their wisdom in fact is the recognition of how much they don't know. Now the point of it is with, and I have seen this with meditation practitioners over and over again. I'll get a student and they start asking questions and another question and another question and another question until I begin to interrupt them. Because the point is that the practice itself is simple enough. You don't need a lot of information. Okay? But in fact, more and more and more knowledge, more and more and more understanding is going off in an extreme, okay? And that no knowledge, no understanding, ignorance is bliss, is going off in the other extreme. All right. But there is a sweet spot in the middle where you know enough to stop asking questions and start enjoying what you do have.
And that is that that is why when coming through this area, I really did want to see you and to meet you, because I can see the wisdom in that supra mundane Dhamma, the simplicity, the grounded nature, without the external artifice, just gladden the mind. And I still do see a wisdom in some of that greater architecture of philosophy, but if it's not founded upon a wholesome structure, it leads to ignorance.
It just winds up being more and more and more going off into an extreme, getting caught in wanting to know. You see, we were kind of taught by our school systems that we're supposed to know, and that a child gets a certain amount of satisfaction by being able to do well on the test. And so the ignorance or the delusion that comes in is that, oh, that's the way to live our life, is to gain enough knowledge so that we'll be happy. Others go gain enough money so they'll be happy. Others will gain enough women in order to be happy, etc. like that. But gaining more knowledge in order to be happy is just the same old problem. That in fact you can see that many drug addicts become quite expert in all of the various drugs, both the ones they've taken and the ones they haven't yet.
I can absolutely see moments in my life where I can go on these philosophical binges on YouTube, like I'm taking knowledge in like a drug, just more and more and more, and just there is no end to it, especially on the internet. There is information until the end of time, and it doesn't necessarily help, for sure.
Right. One of the examples that I use is, imagine that the dean or the president of the university has thrown a big party for some reason or another. Maybe it's the end of the semester or his daughter's getting married or something like that. And all of the old distinguished professors come to the party. Let's say that there's 30 or 40 of them, and each one of them has their expertise, and each one of them is very proud that they know their subject matter. But the point is that you've got a whole room full of people who are ignorant of 29 other expertises, right? That there is a complete limit to the amount of knowledge that we can have. So let's start looking at the point of what knowledge is really valuable. And the real valuable knowledge is this dukkha right here in front of us. If you can see that this is dukkha, then you can see immediately that I'm creating that dukkha because of the ignorance that I have. And the only thing that I have to learn is to shut up, to stop listening to my own crap, to stop criticizing myself for it, and just to relax.
When you say this right here, are we coming back to the idea that suffering itself, or existence itself, is suffering or dissatisfactory?
Well, no. In fact, a lot of people would say that. There was a bumper sticker in the 1980s that I was familiar with. Because I saw a picture of one or two or three or four of them. But the bumper sticker said, life is shit, and then you die. Well, what that actually means is that people are missing the point, that you actually have a survival instinct that will go so to try to keep you alive, even when that's not a good idea. In other words, it's always going in the direction of staying alive. And then you have all of this suffering and dukkha and worry and whatnot like that about how to stay alive. And so, really, all we need is to stop feeling insecure and unsafe, because the self-preservation instinct is actually, it has its own language, and the language that it uses is fear. That we are in dangerous situation, the self-preservation instinct comes up, and it always comes up in the form of selfishness. It comes up in the form of the self. Now, within Buddhist context, you've heard the word anatta, and it's been translated as no self, not self, where in fact the atta is not a self at all. It's soul. And a soul, what the Buddha taught against was that the soul is considered permanent, everlasting, goes from one life to the next life to the next life. And the fact is that everything is temporary. Everything is in motion. And when we get used to one thing and then things change, that fear comes up because of the self-preservation instinct. And so a great part of our practice is to begin to see the fear that underlies almost all of human behavior, especially for each individual one of us, and to recognize that there's no reason to be afraid. Right now, there is no reason to be afraid. The reality is that there is nothing to fear right now. Here we are sitting on the porch. There are no cops. There is no mafia. Nobody's coming to ask for money. The dog is not sick. All of this kind of stuff, and yet people will feel like they're, like we were talking about the anxiety, because they will think of a cop, yes, or a mafia or a dog being sick.
I can see, again, that's the suffering that the mind is creating, and that is unwholesome and that is unnecessary. But I can also see that people could be sitting on the porch in this, okay, so I could be in a state of anxiety right now, realizing I don't love my partner well. You know, I might not have her as a wife, and I might not have my grandchildren one day, and not to go into some mental spiral about the future.
And the wife and the children are not here right now.
But what I mean is, let's bring it away from that, though. If I don't feel a sense of need or fear or dis-ease in order to go out to my field at 4 a.m. and plant my crops, I will starve. And that's, you know, you can take that into any situation where the feeling of terror, not terror per se, but the feeling of anxiety is that of, you know, if you are not prepared, life will come and will swamp you. Not that it's, and it's not trying to hurt you. It's just you just need to do the right work, do the right action.
All right, but you see that still, the victim's attitude.
Well, I'm not saying that there was a victim. I'm simply saying that feeling of fear.
Please listen to me. You use the word life will swamp you.
If unprepared.
Pardon?
If unprepared, if not.
Right. Guess what? You do not have to be prepared for life. What we need to do is to change our attitude. Life is not going to come and swamp you. Life is going to come in the form of a toy to play with.
Well, yeah, and I agree with you there. I see that we don't need to suffer into the actions that are required.
Turn your microphone.
I can absolutely see that. We don't need to suffer while doing the actions that are required to live. But I was saying that feeling, okay, so maybe that is your point, that while sitting on the porch, the anxiety of saying, oh no, I need to plant my crops, you could simply say, life is beautiful, I will go plant my crops. Is that, we don't need to be in terror. Life is a toy, so play with it.
Or you can say, I'll go plant the crop tomorrow.
But maybe you need to plant them today, right? There are things that need
to
be done.
Well, if you know that you need to plant it today, then you can go plant it today happily.
Yes, okay.
Or you can sit and not do it happily.
Yes, okay.
Okay.
And so
whatever you choose to do it happily, whether you do it or not. Okay. Yeah. And that this goes also back to getting it right. You don't have to get it right. You just need to get it happily. You don't have to get all of the knowledge, just enough to be happy.
Do you think that there is a correct path in a wrong path?
Yes, exactly. That's what I'm describing.
Outside of just being happy, though, in terms of action, in terms of conduct in life.
Well, don't do things that make you unhappy. Don't do things that harm other people, because they'll come with their revenge to harm you back, with their conceit.
And that will not make you happy. So if you listen to your own barometer, that is enough.
Mm-hmm. That this goes to the golden rule that Jesus gave out, which is actually kind of selfish in a way. If Jesus had a golden rule, then maybe we can have an air rule, because air is free and gold is really, really valuable. All right. So do unto others the way you want to be done unto will often cause a great deal of trouble if you're S&M, for instance. The example that I often give is that it's Christmas time and the husband gives his wife panties and East Van, and she gives him a blender and some plates. Okay? So she did unto him what she wanted done unto her, and he did unto her what he wanted her to do to him, and both of them are dissatisfied. Right. What we actually have to do is to figure out what someone wants and give them a gift that they would appreciate.
So we could say, rather than do unto others as you would have them do unto you, do unto others as they would like to have done.
Right. Which is basically why that's the underlying reason why Buddhism doesn't proselytize the way that Christianity does. Why? Because Christianity is spread by selfishness, by that golden rule, in the sense of, well, I want to hear about Jesus, therefore I'm going to rub your face in it.
Not to like get bent on a religious, imperative religion thing, but is,
no, this is what we do all the time.
Okay, well,
I'm
so
just using that as an
example. So couldn't we also see those rules, you know, do unto others as you would have do unto yourself, and love thy neighbor as thyself. Isn't that speaking from a kind of a non-dual lens, where Christ has realized all things are the kingdom of God, that man, that your brother is you. And he's talking to an audience of people who have not had that.
He's talking to an audience
who is
of
not,
idiots.
Yeah, exactly. And so he knows this, he's understood this, and he's trying to say, how can I tell somebody who has not yet seen non-dual, interdependent, total reality to then treat each other well? Well, okay. Love your neighbor like it is you, even though it is you. Just try to do that. And, you know, do unto others as you would have them do to you, because they are you, kind of.
I have to use this as an example, just because we've gotten into it. Okay. Caiaphas was the head of the temple in Jerusalem at the time when Jesus. Now, if the Buddha had been in that position, the Buddha would have gone to Caiaphas and said, don't you think that you'd be a little bit better off with all of these money changers and all of these bankers were out in the courtyard under tents, leaving the temple to doing the sacred things? But Jesus didn't think about that. He wasn't thinking about what Caiaphas wanted. He talked about what he wanted, and he didn't like the money changers. And so, basically, if there is one rule that people should get out of Christianity, is don't mess with bankers. Because that's what did him in. He messed with the bankers. He didn't do what they wanted
to do. So you think the reason he was crucified, because he messed with the mafia, basically.
Right, he messed with the Jewish mafia.
I've never heard that connection. That's actually pretty good. But
look at the timing. I mean, he went into Jerusalem on a day later. He's in the temple, resting in place.
Was it one day?
He's being hung up.
Okay. Well, that is actually pretty compelling. But I've also heard that story as kind of the tantric view of wrath at times. That sometimes anger in its appropriate place is a sacred action as well. We don't need to have no libido.
Only someone who is angry will justify it. There is always a better way of handling things, and one of them is silence. When you're angry, shut your face.
I just come back to the idea of there are moments when, from my practice and in my traveling and in my contemplation, I can see that all parts of my psyche have a purpose if used correctly. Anger is a very dangerous one because oftentimes you wield it poorly, but anger towards injustice that can rectify injustice, anger towards...
You used the word poorly. What you could have possibly said instead was ignorantly.
Sure, sure. Yeah, of course.
Because the real point about anger is that it is a defense mechanism. You've heard of the idea of offense is the best defense,
sure.
Right? So anger is the offensive part of the defense,
sure.
Which means that the basic foundation is fear. We need to defend ourselves, okay? So righteous anger is only meaning that they are ignorant of that which they are afraid of. And if they were fearless, if they were feeling safe and secure and comfortable, then they could probably handle the situation a whole lot better without being angry. Just like Jesus found out, maybe he never did learn that lesson. He was forgiving them, for they know not what they do. And in fact, he needs to forgive himself for messing with the bankers.
Yeah, I will say I really love that angle. I've never heard that before. And it's a great connection to realize that maybe it was the bankers not offending the rabbis and whatnot. Ignorant action leads to suffering. I can absolutely see that. And maybe I'm not saying it well, but just that there can be moments of wise anger, and maybe it's not flipping tables in a temple and saying...
The only wise anger is to know for sure that you are anger and that it's not appropriate. That's the wise anger, is the wisdom to stop the anger, go to the fear, check out the fear, finish with the fear, and come back to a state of homeostasis.
Because we're talking so much Christianity, I do know there's a line in the Bible that says something like, one of his apostles asks, are we to forgive seven times? And he says, no, we're to forgive seven times seven, which basically means forever. Uh-huh. And
right.
So maybe
there's
that's a good example.
Buddhist take on that.
Well, just before, but that's where what you're saying, the wise action would have been to have forgiven the bankers and said, you know, I don't want to hate you or flip your table or whatever it is, and instead to forgive.
All right. The forgiving one, the forgiveness is done out of ignorance. The reality is that I was offended because I chose to be offended, not that he did something wrong. All right, so I've got to forgive somebody of something to where, in fact, if there's anything, I should get over what they have done without trying to mess with them by forgiving them. Then, in fact, Buddhism in the West, Western Buddhism, has picked up on that Christian concept to where here's a way of thinking about it. There are several stories, and one of them has to do with the fact that a monk does not forgive another monk until that monk comes to apologize and to ask forgiveness, and then forgiveness is given as a gift. But Jesus is on the cross forgiving Pontius Pilate when Pontius Pilate didn't do anything wrong. Pontius Pilate was doing his job. Caiaphas didn't do anything wrong. Caiaphas was defending the temple. The bankers didn't do anything wrong. They were just doing their banking as they saw fit.
I think
that Jesus did not need to say, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Jesus should have said, Father, forgive me, or in fact, me, forgive me, because I'm the one who screwed that up.
Well, I guess just, again, not to defend the story too much, but I can see where what that is, I understand trying to point to, is that there are certain things that are holy, and we should not muddy them with the bribery.
It's not our job to choose what other people's holy is.
So you're saying that these lenders, to them, lending can be a holy thing, so why not?
Well, it's not Jesus's business to decide what's holy or not. Just like, let's go back to that point, is that the only reason that a monk would forgive another monk is because that monk came to apologize and to ask forgiveness so that he would feel better. The first monk then that forgave him didn't have to forgive. What he needed to do instead was to forget, to just forget about it. Okay, Jesus could have walked in that temple and seen all of those bankers, and he could have walked out and says, I'm glad I'm not in that. Wow, I had the thought that I was going to go wreck the place. Boy, I'm glad I didn't do that. I can forget all about it now, because it's not my business. Okay? This is, in fact, we have a very much Christian attitude about we have to fix the world, when, in fact, the world doesn't need fixing. What needs to be fixed is our attitude about what's broken.
I guess I've heard you bring up a few times how in the West, oftentimes, Dhamma teachers will charge an obscene amount of money for a teaching. And I think that that's similar.
A penny is obscene.
Well, that's similar to what Christ is saying, that to be lending in the temple is an obscene act because these things are holy ways and we should not bring this into
it. Yeah, but it's their obscenity, not mine.
Sure. No, I can see that. But I think that that's what he was upset about.
It would be obscene for me to do that. Therefore, I abstain from taking money from other people. And that it's wise to know that that's what's happening. But we don't have to condemn those who do that because, in fact, they have been trained. That they went to Jack Kornfield and got trained to charge money. He charged them money. That was their training. That's exactly how a parent teaches a child. A child grows up and goes the way he should go because he saw his parents going that way.
And most likely, 2,000 years ago in that temple, those moneylenders, their parents were probably bankers. Mm-hmm. And so they were simply doing the family business. And you can so you can see with the level of compassion, this is simply the karma of where they came from. This is the cause and effect that led them to now having the table that was once their grandfather's.
And can Jesus just be happy seeing that going on?
Okay. So when we said that there's nothing to change, again, in my attempt at understanding.
Well, our attitude is what needs to be changed,
but also
not the bankers.
Well, so the attitude, I think Buddha said that the mind precedes all things, from the mind all things follow.
That was Buddha.
Yeah, in the Dhamma.
Jesus doesn't say that.
No, that's what I said. That's what I said. I said the Buddha. The Buddha said okay. That. Yeah, yeah. And so I can see that the mind is where the first and foremost, where sin needs to be eradicated, right? But to say that man has nothing to fix, yes, the mind is where it proceeds. But I think that, to fix the mind is to fix the action within the world. But to say that the world is not in a state of disrepair, environmentally, socially, within wars, within mass kind of late stage capitalism, that there is nothing wrong. Do you not think that there is a proper health to the environment and culture and to self?
Yes, exactly. When you come up on my porch, that's the time to teach you the Dhamma, but I am not going to go chase you down on the motorcycle and try to fix you.
Yeah, you're not going to proselytize. You're not
exactly.
Going to go out there and, yeah.
Exactly.
You're not going to be the guy in Piccadilly Square on the box saying, the end is nigh, the end is nigh, repent, repent. Yeah.
Because the guy who is on the box in Piccadilly Square is probably the most unhappy person in Piccadilly Square, especially because of the treatment that he's getting from the people. All right. So, the world is a very, very big place. I can be victimized by that really big world, or I can stop being affected by it and start looking at my own mind to recognize that, no, I didn't get victimized by the world. I victimized myself and blamed the world for my own self-victimization. When I stop victimizing myself, then the world becomes irrelevant.
But isn't that stepping away from the duty of man to the world, where
Have a duty, but not to the world. Well, my duty is to the Dhamma.
But the Dhamma extends into the coral reef. It extends into to your neighbor. And so, like, my feeling of...
But I cannot fix the coral reef. But, in fact, many of the divers that are down there trying to fix the coral reef are probably messing with it instead.
What I meant by the coral reef is just that our individual self extends beyond our own bodies. I mean, we are interdependent with the literal rivers, the movement of clouds.
Yeah, so stop messing with them.
Well, that's my... So the dissatisfaction, the suffering people feel could be the wise... I had a Buddhist nun once tell me that as you wake up, there comes a moment of she called it a sacred or a significant sacred sadness. As you realize your union with more and more of life, you also feel their own state of suffering within you, and it causes you to try to help. She was Mahayana. She took the Bodhisattva vow, and so this is a different frame.
That's the Bodhisattva vow. I understand that. In fact, I've given several talks to several groups of students about it, okay? The Bodhisattva vow is, if we can put Buddhism in three levels, the fully ignorant, then the mildly stupid, and then the wisdom. And she's in the mildly stupid category. This is what the Bodhisattva really is. The Bodhisattva is the one who is seeking, let us say, enough knowledge, but they haven't found it yet. They're still the pilgrim. Now, you have the farmer that's sitting on his farm, unhappy, and then you have the pilgrim who is out going on the pilgrimage to find the holy place. But once the pilgrim gets to the holy place, he's only going to stay for a short time. And then he's already in the habit of a pilgrim. He's going to pick his pilgrimage up and go to the next holy site. When is he going to wise up to figure out that once he gets to the holy site, he has arrived already? Okay, so the Bodhisattva, how many tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people have taken the Bodhisattva vow, in the sense of may all beings be happy, and that I'll wait to be the last one through the gate. Now, wait a minute, just hang in there. And so now you have 100,000 of them. They're the only ones left. They've saved everybody else. They've saved every farmer and every pilgrim, and every enlightened being is already in there. And now the Bodhisattvas are there to battle it out. You go next. No, I'm going to wait. You go next. And so they're fighting with each other because of this stupid vow that they have taken. They can't just prance through the gate, arm in arm, right? Here's the point then. The gate is not a one-way gate. The gate is an open door. You can come in and out freely, your choice. So if you find something, you're inside, but you find somebody stumbling around, maybe a Bodhisattva or so, you can grab your, go outside the gate, grab them by the arm and pull them in. Yeah. That's the whole thing is that this idea of it's a boundary and that you're either not in it or you're in it is the duality.
I don't think she was thinking of awakening as a boundary as much as your consciousness rises, as you expand beyond that myopic self to a greater conception of what the self truly is, one of the things that you will experience is you will feel compassion as the, you know, as the, when you see the videos of war, when you realize the coral reef is dying. And it's not that you cannot then be in your own union with truth in the way, but that you will feel part of that union.
That is the ordinary, almost Christian view of compassion. Misery loves company. And when misery loves company, they find someone, bodhisattva or whatever, comes by. They want to make the bodhisattva miserable too. And the bodhisattva is quite miserable enough to have a pity party right along with them. Okay, so take this analogy. You're on board a huge fishing boat, which, you know, huge fishing boats can handle pretty heavy weather. But the people who own that ship cannot handle the heavy weather unless they're well trained. So somebody goes overboard. What are you going to do, Mr. Compassionate One? Are you going to go jump over the side with them? Are you going to try to save them from their drowning?
Yeah. Well,
no, just hang on. Are you going to, you see, when someone's drowning, they will use anything that they will pull you under to try to save themselves.
They do.
And so the better thing to do is to not jump in the sewer with them.
Yeah.
To stay out of it. Okay,
yes.
Turning my mic. So when you are dealing with someone, there's your compassion, you don't have to go commiserate with them. You can stay in a state of joy and have them come out of their joy or out of their state of misery into a state of joy too. When someone is angry, dealing with someone with anger, the easiest thing, the better thing to do is to be away from them, be distant from them. But if you are in a situation where that's a bit difficult, then the way to handle somebody else's anger or sadness or whatever, let us say, high seas that they're floundering in, is to do it with joy. You've got your own foundation. You are not being disturbed by them. So as Jesus walks into the temple and sees all of that happening, he does not have to see that those people are drowning. He can say, well, that's what they're doing, and he can happily walk out. All right? Here's the point that you keep missing is that the world somehow needs saving. You brought up this nun. Let me mention to you about her is that when she thinks about all the sadness of the world, she becomes sad too. She's jumping back into the ocean. She is not keeping herself above that. That compassion is wise compassion. Karuna does not jump into the misery because somebody else is having a pity party and misery loves company. This is an important quality that we have to recognize, that she could be quite joyful when she thinks about all the suffering and all the misery of the world. But guess what? Most of the people she thinks is miserable and suffering, when they're confronted with it, they'll disagree. Oh, I'm not angry. Oh, I'm not sad. I'll handle it, you know. They don't want our help, okay? So you talked about duty for a moment. Let's talk about what is the duty to the Dhamma, which means that our duty is not to the world. Our duty is to be in reality, okay? And reality is that we do not have to deal with the world in its position of being faulty. That in fact, you begin to see the world as a paradise with an awful lot of people in it who just don't understand it's a paradise, but you keep it as a paradise because of your attitude, and you don't have to fix them. It's still a paradise. You don't have to fix anybody, but if somebody comes to you and wants to know about paradise, you can describe that to them happily. But you don't have to save the world because the world's not broken. what's broken in that regard is your attitude about the world. You think it's broken when in fact it's not.
I'm with you there. I can see that in maintaining the joy and the beauty of the world, that it is beautiful in its right, in its own right, keeping that alive rather than jumping into the milieu of suffering that is commonly in the world is the right thing to do. When we say that the world is not broken, again, I just think, I mean, I've worked in a lot of refugee camps. I've worked with people who have had their sisters
burned. A lot of people who were in a paradise called a refugee camp and they don't like it.
Well, I'm saying I've personally met people who've had true war crimes and atrocities done to them through my work as a photojournalist. And I've been in environments that have been ecologically destroyed. And so I've seen these
but
things.
But you did not save them. They did no, not well, become
but,
happy.
But my,
in fact,
but my,
you were
my
invited
point,
in and but, you became unhappy.
No, I didn't become unhappy. But my point there was to share parts of the world so the ignorance that we all live within will be illuminated. And hopefully we then will change our conduct. The root of suffering is ignorance, as Buddha said, right? And so part of alleviating that is the understanding of what's going on in the world. So similarly, not that the world itself is fallen and terrible, and I think the world is transcendent and beautiful. Actually, in my deepest meditation, the words that came to me were the sacredness of being, that this is holy, this is all holy. But the points...
I hear that.
The points,
okay,
yes,
so
and the
not.
Points of suffering... No, the points of suffering are where we do not perceive that. And so then we murder our brother, we rape our sister, we burn down the forest for a hamburger. Those are the points of suffering that we need to have greater awareness of so we do not do any longer.
You need to have greater awareness, and it's none of your business whether other people have that awareness or not. Because if you go out to try to fix them, they're going to make you into a hamburger.
Yeah, and I can absolutely see that there's nothing I can do that can change anyone's mind. I can think for 10 million years and I cannot move the smallest pinky, your pinky. I cannot make anyone do anything. And you're right. The only locus of power I have is my own mind, my own body. But with that mind and body, it seems to be to then, in your own action right now, speaking the Dhamma to me, you're putting a hand out. Right. And it seems that that's something that we kind of are called to do, to put our hands out metaphorically and literally in the world, in helping the world come to the way, come to the Dhamma.
One person
at a time. Sure. Absolutely. Of course. And I think that that's one of the negative things of the Christ story, is that they made it superhuman. They made Jesus into this magic man, rather than a man who taught a way of being that is simple and is actionable. They made it into a fairy tale. And a lot of Buddhism, they've done that to the Buddha in many cultures, where Buddha is a 30-foot tall golden man, right, with big feet. And this was not what Buddha was. And this is what Buddha explicitly said, I am not. But still, so we've made these stories. And I think a lot of those stories have been more entrenched maybe in Christianity, that made it more warped and confusing. But still, nonetheless.
Well, let us say this: that there is an awful lot of ignorance within Christianity, and almost no wisdom. That while there is an awful lot of ignorance within Buddhism, there's still enough of the wise ones. There's still enough nobles that to pass it down from one generation to another. That I was quite fortunate to have gotten close to Bhikkhu Buddhadasa and Achan Po so they could transmit this point. And so we were talking about the duty to the Dhamma. Basically, to say the duty to the Dhamma is to pay it forward, even though the Buddha talks about that we owe a great deal of gratitude to our moms and our dads, that even if you carried mom and dad on your shoulders around for the rest of your life, you can still not repay them for the childhood rearing and the birth and all. However, in our way of society, the way that a child will repay his parents is by passing on what he get from them down to the next generation. And that this is how the Dhamma is paid. That's the problem with that you find in Western Buddhism of people paying the teacher is that they have lost their sense of generosity and lost their sense of obligation because the teacher himself has lost it. He's not in teaching the Dhamma because he's obligated to do that through his duty to the Dhamma. He's out there trying to make a living. And so the right way to teach the Dhamma is to be in a position to where you don't need nothing. You don't need the money. You don't need anything. You've got your life completely straightened out. You don't need the money. You don't need the love. You don't need the students. You don't need any of that kind of stuff. And then you can just do your duty to the Dhamma one person at a time when they would come. That's the duty to the Dhamma. I don't owe the big wide world nothing.
But in order to do that, you need to have resources. You need to have money and ability and shelter and food, and which requires
well,
finances.
Requires us to have the wisdom to take care of all the business that needs to be taken care of without wanting something from somebody else.
I can absolutely see that we need to take care of our own self, not to then be compensated by others and helping them, but simply we are taken care of. I've taken care of my own responsibilities, and out of love and simply passing down, I can help in whatever way I can, not in compensation. And I think that's exactly what Christ was doing in the temple. I mean, this to go back to that story, it was the idea that this is not meant to be sold. This is not meant to be bartered. And I can see that.
He didn't teach Caiaphas bankers anything.
I hear that.
They strung him up.
These are stories in a book, but I'm just saying that I think what was trying to be said in that story.
The story would have been a lot different if he'd have stayed out of that temple.
Totally, probably would have. That's a great point. And I've never heard that point made, that it was the mafia bankers that killed him. But I think what is in its
killed him out of revenge.
But in giving that story the most benefit rather than just to steel man it rather than straw man, I think what is trying to be said is there are things in this world that are holy, like the Dhamma, and in these spaces and in this world, we cannot simply...
Everything is holy.
Exactly. Everything is holy. And that is where you just said you should be completely conducting yourself so you're not charging even a single penny. Everything is holy. And banking where banking is right, here is where the Dhamma is right. And don't bring your lending tables here to take advantage of those who come to the temple to seek their truth, to seek God. Don't manipulate them. There's the other one of the unspoiled calf or whatever, and how they would have these people outside the temple who would have to judge your offerings. And they would always say, well, your offering isn't good enough. You have to buy this offering. And again, it's manipulating man's seeking of the divine through commerce and materialism and tribal kind of bullying, right? And I think without...
puts everybody in that victim's position of nothing is ever good enough.
Well, especially when the arbiters between you and seeking truth are telling you you're not good enough. You need to buy my calf. You need to take my loans.
The guy who's selling the cat needs to sell the cat because things for him are not good enough. Everybody, even the most wealthy, even the biggest generals, even the politicians at the top, everybody is suffering ignorantly. We're all, the whole world is full of it.
Yeah, I can
not
see.
Not one person is naturally free.
We're all coming from a place of not seeing the sacredness of what is in front of us. And again, I think that's where part of healing that is to, as you say, live in the sacredness. Your own responsibility is to then live in that sacredness, and then when, not to go out and proselytize, but when somebody comes to you and says, what do you have? Then you share. And that's it. I can see that. I agree with you there. I mean, I think you're right. Yeah.
So then that means that we don't have to fix the world. The world is not broken. The world is, in fact, a holy, sacred place.
I see that. I agree with you.
I have an old joke about that. when I was a monk in North Carolina, I had a lot of Christians who would come and talk, and there was a monastery within 30 miles or so that was often had visitors, and then for some reason they'd come to visit us after they went to the monastery having all kinds of questions. And one of the questions was about barefoot, and that I would tell them the story that, well, what did the burning bush say to Moses? The first thing the burning bush said to Moses was, take off your shoes, for thy are upon holy ground. Okay? Well, see, I'm in the possibility, I'm in the danger of being in holy ground anytime, so I just keep the shoes off because I'm ready for it. I'm already there. Holy ground, here it is. And yet the pilgrim goes from holy site to holy site and misses the point that he's already in that holy place.
Yeah, the whole world is sacred, for sure. But similarly, when you go to Bodh Gaya, they do make you take your shoes off. And I think it's not saying that you cannot, I don't think anyone would care if you, but this is a reverence of respect to what happened here. And so take your shoes off as a way of, it's ceremony. It's a way of triggering to the mind that this is a sacred place to be. And so you do something, that's why you bow, prostrate, all of these things.
It also has the advantage that you have to watch where you're going.
Yeah, exactly. And so it brings you into awareness, right? Not that shoes are not sacred, right? Shoes are fine, but by removing them, it brings your awareness. It's not that the body is dirty, but sometimes covering the body is a way of bringing awareness to something else, right? And yeah.
Okay. So this whole conversation that we've been having has to do with getting you to turn away from the world and the outside and fixing it, bodhisattvas and nuns who cry over this crap they see and all of that kind of stuff, and recognize that you create everything that Jesus in the 17th chapter of Luke says, behold, the kingdom of God is within. In Matthew, he said the kingdom is within arm's length, or is at hand. That's the word to use. Right, here it is. Everything that needs to be done is right here and available. This is the change, because Christianity has gotten all messed up, and Buddhism in the West has gotten all messed up, partly because the Asians were messed up, and then Christianity has really messed up Western Buddhism. Okay, we really need to come back to the issue. Is the only issue is this thought that you're having right this very moment. That's the only task that we have. That's our duty to the Dhamma, is to fix this thought, to come out of unwholesome thought into wholesome thought. And when you're in wholesome thought, when the attitude is wholesome, then the world's not broken. The attitude from the victim is the way that we were raised. Every child is raised a victim. We have to, all we can do is suck. But we can't put the tit in our mouth. Somebody's got to do that for us. We can't change our own diaper. All we can do is crap, but we can't change our own diaper. Then we're told to go to school. We're told to do what? Clean your room, up 2, 3, 4, learn your ABCs. And so we continue to be a victim. We are trained as victims. We started as a victim, and we wind up as a victim. And here you are, a victim to both the world and to your victimhood. So what we really need to do is start recognizing that you're creating now the victimhood, because you've been in the habit of doing that since day one, and that we can change that attitude from being a victim into being okay, being the winner. Okay. And so when we have that attitude that you're okay, I'm okay, the world is okay, let's just enjoy life. There is nothing that needs to be fixed except for that which the victim wants to fix. And the world has a lot of victims in it, but I am not a victim to the victims of the world.
And again, we do that by simply A, B, C, instead of D, go to E. I see you, Mara. I catch that moment.
And change this moment right now.
We don't force it into being glad. We just simply aware.
I don't need to know more stuff. I already know enough. I've got everything I already need. I'm already okay. That's the point. You're already okay. We have to keep coming back.
But when you say that, immediately I feel in my body ways that I'm not okay. And immediately.
That's how those are your attitudes, though, that need to start to change.
But I mean,
see that.
Yeah,
say, uh-huh,
no, so that's what I'm saying.
I see you, Mara.
But I see the ways that at times I've eaten unhealthily, the ways I've not always worked out strongly, the ways I've not always worked my mind deeply, the way I've related to, you know, escapism. All of this, right? And it's like I feel.
Well, forget about it.
But my mind, again, I'm not saying I'm not wrong, but I'm just to voice it out. I feel that inner wisdom saying, you could be okay, of course. Just stop
you
doing this
be.
Shit. But you have, but like you have to stop touching the stove. Stop touching the stove. Stop touching the stove. And it's like,
stop hating yourself for touching the stove. The stove may not be all of that hot. You can handle that heat.
Maybe. But I mean, and maybe I'm too entrenched in that thought, but it just.
Most of the time, stoves are not hot. They're only hot once a day when people put fire
but
in.
But for example, people are in the West are having lower lifespans. I mean, we are in a crisis of health, basically, right? And so we are doing things that are destroying us physically.
Well, that's
mentally.
Only a long period of time of having longer and longer lifespans. And in some places, the lifespan is going up. The reason that the lifespan turned around in the United States, it started going down is because of Donald Trump.
Oh, no, it happened long before that.
No, it did. It was the COVID. That's the whole
thing. No. This was happening in the 90s where the children's lifespans were predicted shorter than their parents. And a lot of it had to do with diet, lack of physical health, lack of getting outside. And so what I'm saying is there are actions we're doing that are detrimental. And it's like, stop touching the stove. And yet clearly as a population, as an individual too, we keep touching the stove.
Here's the point that I'm making though. You keep talking about stop touching the stove. That's being critical.
Yeah.
You're critical of them touching the stove, where in fact the stove is not hot, but 30 minutes or an hour a day. The rest of the time, it's okay to touch the stove. I can go in there and touch the stove all I want to because it's not burning. What we really need to do is to check things out. Is the stove hot? And if it's hot, then we can not touch it. But you're making rules now, and instead of recognizing that things change on a regular basis. Sometimes the stove is hot, sometimes it's not. What we really need to do is investigate to see that sometimes when you say the stove is hot, don't touch it, you're correct. And sometimes you say don't touch the stove, it's hot. And now somebody can't even light the stove because they're afraid the stove is already hot.
Maybe,
in fact, it's not.
Maybe that metaphor is at its end of use. But what I'm pointing at the stove is that our environment is filled with more things than ever that are detrimental to the mind and to the body,
so
to the psyche.
All right, so let's change that word stove then to wrongdoing.
Well, exactly. That's my point. So
right,
whatever.
And sometimes what you do is wrong and sometimes it's not.
But there are certain
you're
things.
You're making a rule to make it long-term wrong. In fact, you don't know that.
Cigarette smoking is always detrimental to the lungs, right?
Not necessarily. It depends upon what you're smoking. It depends. In fact, here's something that the tobacco industry used for years, and that was is that the people who smoked fewer than 5 cigarettes a day tended to be healthier than those who smoked a lot. Why was that? Was because when they would take a big deep drag, they were actually taking in a whole lot of air. And so they were breathing a whole lot better when they were having a few cigarettes, okay? So you can't then say that cigarettes are 100% bad. That's still a rule.
Well,
what we need to do is to look at what's really going on.
Well, wouldn't cigarettes still be 100% bad, but breathing is good? And so it's like saying, okay, you go and eat McDonald's, and those people who eat McDonald's are better than people who starve to death.
Well,
yeah, that's true.
What we're talking
but
about.
Processed food, is destroying hormones.
Looking at what's going on, rather than saying the stove is always hot. Here's the point. The word that we're looking for in Nepali is Sila Bhatta Paramasa. Have you ever heard the word?
Sila, yes.
Sila is the rules, okay? It's the precepts. It's the Ten Commandments. It's the Sharia law. It's a mom telling the kids not to do what they're, you know, do what I tell you to do, right? Sila Bhatta Paramasa is actually our attachment to the rules. We make rules and then we think the rules are good, but in fact, each and every rule has more exceptions than the rule. That in fact, we have to stay in the moment. For what we've been talking about, for instance, is that you're very critical of yourself. You're very critical of the world. You've got a set of rules and a set of standards that you're clinging to, and you can see that you're clinging to those rules, and now you can start looking at how things really are in this present moment, rather than trying to hold it up to some standard of how things should be. Now, this is...
doesn't that standard give us something? Isn't that the Dhamma? That is the golden Buddha, the statue? These are the ideals.
For ignorant, stupid people. They need the rules. That's why we give rules to the kids, is because they're too stupid to figure out what's right and what's wrong.
But rules would also
an opportunity to stop looking at the rules and start looking at reality.
Yes. No. So again, we're trying to coalesce my own entire life's journey. I don't have a bunch of rules arbitrarily in my mind. I have experiences that I've understood are positive and negative, and then I'm trying to convey that in an hour into a conversation. And so I don't have a Ten Commandment stone above my head. I have experience, deep meditation, looking into certain parts of my own psyche and seeing the outcome of certain parts of my own conduct. So there is that. To say that there is not a orientation among the world, that nihilistic kind of, I'm not saying that is what you're saying, but there is ways of being that are more and less beneficial, that are more advantageous and less advantageous. And so if you look back at I don't want to get too big philosophically, but that is what I'm trying to articulate, is that experience leads you to understand that there are things in this world that are beneficial and are not. And man is attempting, I think, in these rules that we give to kids, if they're good rules, they're the rules that were made by wise men.
Then you'll mess up the next time when that rule doesn't apply.
Sure, but there are certain rules that do apply, right? Like just in simply, in how to love one another and in gladdening the mind, right? That these are ways of living that are more beneficial.
3 superego, ego, and id. Very difficult for most people to understand. Eric Byrne, one of his students, realigned the language to parent, adult, and child, where the superego is actually the parent. Now, the parent has 2 qualities. One is that the parent is critical of the child, and the other one is that the parent is nurturing. We start off nurturing our infants and we wind up being critical of them in childhood and we remain critical. This is where the Buddha talks about Sila Bhatta Paramasa, is all the rules that we carry around in our head. And then we have the id, or the child ego state. And the child is basically the point of wrong view of I want it and I can get it and get away with it. And the parent has the perspective of no, you can't get away with it. We've got rules here. Okay. And so most of the people in the world being in a state of victimhood actually victimize themselves with this internal dialogue between what should be done and what they want. Like, for instance, you should go on a diet and I want that ice cream. All right? So this is the duality that we're all stuck in, is the distinction between what we want and how things ought to be. This is wrong view and ordinary right view. And then Eric Byrne brings up that third ego state, which is what he calls the adult, that I'm referring to now as reality, the way things actually are. And we continuously need to keep looking at what's real rather than what we want or how things ought to be, but just to look at the reality that is right in front of us. Now, when we say the reality, we're not talking about the reality in Tong Sala. We're not even talking about the reality over at Wat Po. The only reality that we can experience is right here, right now, and yet much of this conversation has been big things that we don't know anything about, but we're still holding on to the rules that we've made and holding on to what we want, rather than looking at things the way that things really are. And so we need to start doing that within our own mind, to start looking at, is this what I want? Or is this some sort of rule that I made, and what's real? And the reality is that almost always that conflict is unwholesome between what the child inside wants and what the parent is saying how things should be.
So
start looking at the reality.
And part of that reality is understanding that you are both that child and parent, and understand that, you know, you want to go on the diet, but a part of you does want the ice cream. And so not hating the part of you that wants the ice cream, nor hating the part of you that wants the diet.
Because
and then,
you are, in fact, neither one of those things.
And then as the adult, realizing I will eat well and exercise, whatever. And like choosing that with wisdom.
No, it's actually the adult is the one who says it's okay for you to get old, fat, and die. And it's also okay for you to go on a diet.
Okay.
Yes. But it doesn't really matter. You see,
the child
wants something and the adult wants something, and we're going to go back and forth between that duality, and the reality is neither one of them. It's okay to get bad, get sick, and die.
And maybe that's my superego, right, who comes in and has this hyper-idealized view of what the world is meant to be and man is meant to be. But what immediately slaps back is that man is a noble creature meant to live nobly. The Romans viewed
that's a rule.
The Romans viewed themselves as the descendants.
If that were true, then most men would live nobly. The fact is that only about 3-5% of us live.
And that is why we suffer. We suffer because we live in discord with the way. That is our problem. And the right action is then to live.
Yeah, but that's our choice.
Well, if we're in ignorance, it's the question of how much choice we have if we're unaware. And
that's why I'm saying wake up and take a look at what's going on.
But from waking up,
you can't tell people to do that. I've been talking to you about it, and you keep coming back with all of the rules and all the stuff that you want.
Well, and I can't just blindly.
Nothing matters. It's all just real.
But that's what I'm saying. I feel like it does matter. Life does matter. And
it doesn't matter.
I mean,
planet Earth would be much better off without humans.
The planet Earth also gave birth to man. Life gave birth to man. Man is a product of the cosmos as much as the sun and the light, and actually the gravity that binds the world.
Actually, I would say that it was monkeys who did it, and now that
where did monkeys come from, though, right? Where did monkeys come from? I mean, man brings vision into the world. If there were no the Zen koan of if a tree falls in the forest and no one hears it, doesn't make sound, because man is a relational.
That's a philosophy. That's not a Zen koan.
It absolutely is in Zen. It
that's Zen master or Zen dude.
He's pointing to the fact that man is a relational phenomenon to the cosmos itself. Man creates hearing as much as sound.
No, that's the whole point to make, is that does the tree fall in the forest? Does it make a sound when nobody's there? The absolute is, what is a sound?
That's the point. Sound is only a phenomenon in relation to something that can hear.
No, sound, if you're an engineer, sound is vibration.
Yeah, but that's somebody who has not understood the koan.
You don't have to have the microphone on.
No, but that's the point, though. That's,
in fact, the worm that got crashed on by that tree, but he knows that it happened.
Well, that would be somebody there to hear it. But no, that's the point, is that somebody who has not yet understood that koan has not seen that sound and subject and object are relational. You can have sound waves, but sound waves are not sound without a hearer, without consciousness to perceive it.
No, sound waves are sound waves. For instance, a microphone can pick up those sound waves and nobody heard it until you play it back later, but maybe it didn't get recorded.
But someone is still hearing it. That's the point. Someone is still hearing it. And so this cosmos is a relational phenomena, partly including man. Man literally brings the sunrise into vision. Right. If there were no eyes in this cosmos,
that's actually a delusion. There's no such thing. The sun doesn't rise.
It rises when our Earth circumambulates it. Right. It rises in the morning sun in the sky.
But that's a misperception.
Well, that's also not a misperception, because there is no center of the universe. So actually, everything could be center. So where you sit, the entire universe could be considered to be spinning. Right. Depending on how you.
When you see the sun coming up over the horizon, that's a misperception.
Yes. All I'm saying is that koan of man hearing or seeing means that man is a relational aspect of the cosmos. And back just to that, then man has a duty to live nobly. That man has a duty to inform himself, to be strong, to be noble, to love deeply, to pray ardently, to surrender to the Dhamma, to live a beautiful life, because we are a benefactor and a pro.
Now you're taking on my point.
I wasn't defending the Bodhisattva. Well, to a degree, though, if man realizes what he is, that he realizes his responsibility-backed thing that created him, which is cosmos, which is nature, which is environment. And from that, then, when people live ignorantly and destroy...
Well, his nature and his environment, though, are not the whole world. The whole world is a conceptualized thing.
But still, that's just...
The reality is right.
Yes, and that's just taking my words, though. My point was not a concept. It was understanding nature and man's relationship to it. And we can have that concept that extends beyond our vision if we have maps and if we have understandings of environments and ecosystems, and that his raising awareness draws him into responsibility. His understanding of health requires him to health. His understanding of wisdom requires him into education. It's that Greek ideal of the perfect man is both an Olympian, a philosopher, and a politician.
Absolutely.
I mean, it is my own faulty soul that is weakened, that is not strong enough to take the mantle of responsibility. That, you know, I have a woman I love, yet I've not proposed to her. I have a chance to be in Harvard, yet I've not fully submitted to it. I have had...
Here's a bigger responsibility, though, that you're ignoring. You have a responsibility to have wholesome thoughts. Yes. You have a responsibility to change your attitude.
And I agree with you.
You have a responsibility to be joyful and happy and to spread that joy and happiness.
And I entirely agree.
That's the only responsibility.
And I will say, I mean, that's where we started the conversation. I think your teaching on gladdening the mind, I need to know how to do this, because you're right. You're right. That foundational level, whatever other architecture, true architecture, comes from it, that foundation of gladdening the mind is foundational. It's the first rung.
The architecture you speak with, I would talk about it in the sense of conceptualization, perception, not real. I mean, just like the sunrise is not real.
Sunrise is real to a man who sits on a beach.
Sunrise is perceived to be real.
To a man on a beach, it is direct
experience. To the man on the beach, it is perceived to be real. People come to this island so that they can watch the sunrise. Yeah. What they're really looking for is feeling good, and they use the sunrise as an example or as an excuse.
The sunrise also, though, is putting himself in front of something infinitely bigger than him and a part of him. And so we sit in front of the mountains.
We're always in that place.
Totally.
The paradise that we're in is always infinitely bigger than we are. This house is bigger than I am.
But
As I said before,
I'm going to a state of awe by just looking at all this old wood.
If we took some LSD, it'd be very easy to get into a state of profound awareness that this was once a tree in a forest. And, you know, of course. But it is harder to do that around the constructs of society when you're in the face of nature, big nature.
Behind this role of concepts, yeah. It's hard to see reality.
Sure. Yes. But this, undeniably, this porch is as transcendent as a sunrise, for sure, if you have the eyes to see it. But I think people come to Copenhagen or somewhere beautiful to go sit on the beach is because maybe they don't have that wisdom yet to see it here. So right. Then they go there.
Something.
And it's similar to why we sit on the cushion, right? We sit there for 30 minutes, not so that we sit on the cushion forever, but to start bringing the mind to places of awareness and subtlety so that we can go into the world and feel them in all times, right? But we need that practice and that instruction, because otherwise it passes. Clearly, if everybody was wise simply from living, this world would not be what it is.
It's okay the way it is.
Maybe it is. Maybe you might be right.
It's already just fine. You don't know that, and a whole lot of other people don't know that, but God just is. The way things are just okay. All that needs to be changed is your attitude about it. The attitude becomes everything is all right. Everything is fine in this moment. You can't fix the world that's not broken.
I will try to hold on to that because my mind has all of this thing like that. I will try and sit with that and really hold it because, as I've said so many times now, my mind responds to that with other places of meaning, but maybe it is fine as it is. Maybe there is no need for change.
Yeah, the only thing that needs to be changed is your attitude about it. The world is okay, and you can find an awful lot of rules that are going to agree with you about it's not okay, and you can have all of these feelings about it not being okay, and I'm inviting you to start changing those feelings, change your perception, change your attitude, and just let things be okay. That's your duty to the Dhamma, is to appreciate the Dhamma.
Just immediately have my mind flash again as ways to understand this of buck in heat in ruts as they seek to be the most strong to mate of every single blade of grass out here that has fought for the light of the sun, the foliage, and like it is beautiful and okay, and we must struggle nobly for what is righteous and good,
and the Volkswagen that's stuck in the sand in the mud is okay, just the way that it is, stuck in the sand and the mud.
Unless
the hippies don't like
well,
that.
Unless they need to get out of the desert and they're going to die. And like, I know you
it's
could
okay
say
for
that it's
them
okay if
to
they
die.
Die
in the desert,
yeah.
Sitting under the shade of a man who's stuck in the sand.
I do think that man matters.
Because they're going to die anyway.
Of course they're going to die anyway. But if they die prior to, I mean, there's a difference.
Can't they die happily sitting under the shade of a van?
If you're going to die and there's no choice, you have no choice. So you might as well find joy in it and happiness, of course.
That's the point.
But,
yes, why can't we just be joyful and happy whether we're living or dying?
But in the middle of that death and birth, which is definite, we should seek to live in a way that creates beauty and meaning and love and strength and nobility, and that requires us to work hard.
Somebody may not like the beauty.
Sure,
you're doing.
Well, I'm not trying to proselytize. And you're right. A lot of this is towards myself because there was a part of me that I think does buy the line that life doesn't mean much, and be comfortable, and just be comfortable. You know, and I feel like that is the
Mike doesn't mean the thing to Thich Nhat Hanh. He's been dead for 3,000 years.
Yeah, but while he lived, I mean, the Egyptians viewed the cosmos in a very transcendent domain. And maybe they spoke, Carl Jung said something along the, oh no, this is Viktor Frankl, said that man is not given meaning from God, but man must respond to God by what is meaningful. And I think that
that's not correct.
That's what he says. That is what I'm quoting him. But I think that
a philosopher, probably.
He lived through the Holocaust. He was a Holocaust survivor from Auschwitz and Dachau. But that man...
Well, it wouldn't have been anything if he'd have died in that Holocaust.
But through him living, he can speak to us in that we must live nobly, and how that is an order from the cosmos to conduct ourselves. We don't all have to agree with that. Obviously, the Nazis didn't agree with that, right? Obviously, a lot of people
I had a Nazi, I'd make him happy.
A lot of people right now are content to play their video games and kind of sit in their basements and watch. But I just have this really deep...
Yeah, nothing wrong with them doing that. You'll get really unhappy if you try to stop them.
I don't believe the cosmos spins so man can simply go into the basement and decay, and that we have a duty back to those coral reefs and to the light that illumines my eye to live in a way that is in line with the Dhamma. And my suffering is because I'm...
But all of those things are great big concepts in your mind.
But they can be lived.
And you have those concepts and they're preventing you from being joyful and happy right here in this present moment.
So part
of you would be a whole lot better off if you take those concepts about what needs to be done out and just leave things alone. Yeah. Stop trying to fix what's not broken.
I'm not trying to fix the external world. I'm partly saying all of this so I can share my own psyche to you, and you can criticize it. I'm not trying to win an argument or philosophy, but those concepts, I'm not trying to proselytize to change the world. I'm not trying. It is to change my own conduct. It is to wake up to this to this meaning that is life, and. And I do feel as though, at least, I mean, I was raised in the era.
Can you do it right now?
And so that's my point. So doing it
that's the whole point, is forget about those concepts and about what is all there out there and said, wow, right now
yes.
I feel good.
Well,
you haven't done that once since we've been sitting here. Haven't said, wow, things are okay right now.
Things are pretty great right now. And it's lovely to know you and meet you. No, and I agree. And I think that loving the people you're with is how you do that. It is not some big thing. It is sitting with your lover and making dinner. It is reading a good book. It is going to a hike.
All of those, again, are concepts. I'm talking about right this very moment.
This very moment?
Right now.
It is lovely.
You say, wow, everything is okay. Everything is fine. Not a problem.
And immediately my mind goes, I can't say that because you have
to. Coming right back see that that's an unwholesome thought.
Okay.
And throw it out and say, okay, everything right now is okay. Everything is fine.
Yeah. And everything right now is fine. And from there, go into the world that way.
No. Come back and say again. Because, see, you have a thought, I got to go out into the world.
No, well...
But you see that thought, I got to go out. Never mind. Everything right now is okay. Everything is fine. Not a worry in the world, not a problem, no place to go, nothing to do.
But there are things to do.
Then take that thought and throw it out and say, come back and say, I've got no place to go and nothing to do, and everything is okay, everything is fine. And begin to change your attitude.
But that feels like the decay of man, that man is trying to convince himself that there's nothing to do, when you must find a partner, you must find a way to live in this world.
You're going back into all of those conceptualizations yet again.
But that is...
I'm inviting you to drop that for a little while.
But isn't that...
Just say everything is okay right now.
But isn't that nature? I mean, that's the bird calling right now above us, is calling for a mate. And the leaves...
But it's just a beautiful sound. You don't know what that bird is doing. I hear him calling.
To someone who
it's just beautiful. Can you just allow it just to be beautiful without having to make up some sort of story about the bird being horny?
No. Birds primarily call for mates. I study birding. So if that's what they do most of the time.
Yeah, but don't have to have that concept.
It's not
just listen to the bird and enjoy the sound. You're in paradise. You don't have to study birds in order to enjoy the sound.
Of course not. But what I'm trying to say is nature herself is filled with struggling to become, and we are a part of that nature.
I understand that. You have the same attitude of tens of hundreds of millions of people.
Yeah.
That's ordinary thought.
Yeah.
And you still haven't come back to the point of everything right now is okay. Sitting here and listening to the bird call is okay.
Yeah.
You don't have to start thinking about the bird being horny.
But I wasn't. No. I'm trying to use examples.
Talking about it.
Well, to try to share what I'm trying to explain. I'm not just try to share what I'm trying to understand. And so the only way I can share my psyche.
You don't need to understand. That's what we started in the first part of this conversation. You don't need to understand. You need to relax. You don't need to understand all the birds and why they're calling. Just, oh, that sounds beautiful. It's a bird call. It's part of nature. It's part of the reality.
And I am part of that, too. And the Dhamma speaks through all things. And the parts of me that long are the same parts in the bird that call.
It also doesn't have to speak so much conceptualized.
Well, I mean, I would...
Just enjoy. Just sit and relax and enjoy. Everything is okay. Everything's fine. Don't have to fix anything. Nothing is broken. The bird's not broken. The bird's just singing. Allow it to be a song. Everything's okay. Everything is fine. Not a worry in the world. We're okay. Wow, what a relief it is. You don't have to fix anything. Nothing's broken. Everything is all right. Everything's okay. Not a problem. Just sit and enjoy the night. Nowhere to go and nothing to do. The spring comes and the grass grows all by itself.